Welcome to the Lowdown. This is an AI-generated open-source news summary for general informational awareness. This product is not intended for use as official intelligence. The views expressed here are solely those of the cited authors and do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of War, the United States Air Force, or any other U.S. government agency.
Here is your operational BLUF. Total economic attrition is rapidly replacing traditional front lines across major global theaters. U.S. and Iranian kinetic exchanges are directly targeting critical infrastructure and logistics networks to force strategic concessions. Concurrently, Russia and North Korea are adapting through intense economic maneuvers, coercive manpower shifts, and the forward deployment of advanced assets.
Okay, so diving right into the reporting for today's deep dive. We are unpacking a pretty massive stack of intelligence covering three major areas of responsibility, or AORs. We're looking at the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the Korean Peninsula.
Right. And while that sheer volume of global news can feel overwhelming, there is absolutely a unified theme here. We are seeing a shift away from just, you know, simple military attrition.
Yeah, totally. It's about total economic attrition now. Like, adversaries are realizing it's often cheaper to bankrupt a country or just turn off its power than to fight its army head on.
Exactly. And we're going to break down the hidden strategies driving these headlines so you can actually understand the incentives behind them.
So let's start with the most active conflict in the Middle East, AOR, the U.S.-Iran war. The U.S. just completed, I believe it's the 11th consecutive night of strikes against Iran.
It is, yeah, 11th yeah. night. And they aren't localized. The targets span from Tabriz in the north to Tehran, Bushehr, and all the way down to Khuzestan province.
It's a staggering scale.
It really is. The U.S. strategy is heavily focused on degrading Iranian drone storage and logistics, just systematically dismantling the infrastructure they use to project power.
Right. But Iran is obviously retaliating. And their response is geographically widespread, too. They are specifically targeting U.S. bases in host countries, which is a major shift.
Critical shift. They've struck the Doha garrison in Kuwait and the Sheikh Isa Air Base in Bahrain.
And the strikes in Jordan, right? The many Mufaq, Salty, and Azraq bases.
Yes. That specific attack in Jordan was devastating. It resulted in the deaths of two U.S. soldiers.
Which brings the total number of U.S. service members who have died in this conflict to 18.
Right.
And President Trump is currently at Dover Air Force Base for the dignified transfer of remains. It's just, you know, a very stark reminder of the human cost here.
Absolutely. The human cost is rising and the financial toll is astronomical. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth reported that this war has already cost $37.5
billion. $37
billion.
Wow.
Yeah. And the Pentagon is requesting another $90 billion. Just think about the sheer friction of sustaining a conflict across that many theaters.
Right. Burning through billions in days. But it's really about how that money is being spent.
Mm.
It brings us back to that infrastructure war.
The economic attrition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I was reading these reports and it's like, instead of fighting the occupants of a house in the hallway, you're just standing in the yard, cutting the wires and smashing the water pipes.
That's a great analogy. You don't have to defeat the military if you make the country unlivable.
Right. And President Trump is openly threatening to bomb bridges and power plants in Tehran if Iran keeps harassing ships in the Strait of Hormuz.
And Iran is playing that exact same game in reverse. Look at Kuwait. They have been actively attacking Kuwaiti water desalination and power facilities.
Basically trying to make Kuwait City sit in the dark.
Exactly. They want the domestic pressure to build on the Kuwaiti government until they demand U.S. forces leave. Iran wants to prove the U.S. is an unreliable security guarantor.
The geography of all this pressure is wild, especially the islands. Karg Island, for instance. Trump claims U.S. strikes obliterated its military assets, but they deliberately spared the oil infrastructure.
Right, for now.
Yeah. Why leave the oil untouched?
It's pure leverage. Karg Island is the nerve center of Iran's oil exports. Destroying the military base shows the island is indefensible, but leaving the oil intact keeps a sword dangling over Tehran.
A message of, we can turn off your economy whenever we want.
Exactly. Plus, blowing it up would cause a massive shock to the global energy market, which they obviously want to avoid.
Makes sense. But it's not just Karg Island. There's intense speculation about an Iranian ground invasion of Kuwait's Boubian Island.
Right. Boubian is a massive island right near Iraq. Iranian figures have floated, seizing it as a bargaining chip if the U.S. occupies Iranian territory.
And back in May, Kuwait literally intercepted Iranian commandos on that island, the IRGC Sabrin unit. but they arrived in a rented fishing boat.
Yeah, it sounds crazy, but it highlights how unconventional this is. The Saberin unit knows a military vessel would be tracked by radar instantly.
So they just use a civilian fishing boat to slip in.
Right. It blurs the lines and makes early detection incredibly difficult.
Speaking of difficult to detect, let's talk about Pickaxe Mountain, or Mount Kolangas. The reporting on this sounds like a movie. Why is Iran moving nuclear assets into a mountain?
Well, after the June 2025 war, which saw massive strikes on their surface-level facilities, Tehran realized their program was too vulnerable.
So they went underground.
Deep underground. Intelligence suggests they moved thousands of centrifuges and highly enriched uranium into this heavily fortified mountain site.
And Trump is threatening to heavily attack it.
Because burying it under tons of rock makes it incredibly hard to destroy with conventional munitions. It's a race between Iran hardening its shield and the U.S. threatening to shatter it.
Wow. Okay, so that's the direct state-on-state friction. Let's look at the proxy maneuvers. The Houthis in Yemen are blockading Saudi Arabia and the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
But they aren't just taking orders from Tehran, are they?
No, and that's a vital distinction. It's easy to view them as a monolith controlled by Iran, but the Houthis are acting in their own self-interest. They actually ignored earlier Iranian calls to close the Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
Wait, really? So why institute the blockade now?
They only did it after Saudi forces struck Sana'a International Airport.
Ah, okay, so it's local deterrence. You bomb our airport, we choke off your shipping.
Exactly. It just happens to align perfectly with Iran's broader goal of creating chaos and raising oil prices.
Got it. And in Lebanon, following the Israeli withdrawal under the June 26th trilateral agreement, the Lebanese armed forces deployed to places like Zaatar El Garbia.
Right. But Hezbollah is pushing back hard on another front.
Yeah, Hezbollah official Mahmoud Kamadi is threatening to shut down Beirut's Rafik Hariri International Airport using peaceful means. Why the airport?
Because the Lebanese government implemented visa bans on Iranians and banned Iranian aircraft. So Hezbollah is essentially holding the airport hostage to force the government's hand.
Infrastructure is a hostage again. And moving to Iraq, Iraqi intelligence just busted a first-person view drone factory in Baghdad.
Yeah, they seized carbon fiber panels and production equipment. These are the cheap, lethal drones changing the battlefield globally. It's likely tied to militias there.
And those militias have leverage. 10 Iraqi militias refuse to disarm until the U.S. withdraws completely.
They are essentially a shadow military daring the official government to stop them.
It's just a powder keg. And that focus on economic attrition, making an adversary bleed cash. Let's pivot to the Eastern Europe AOR, because we are seeing that flipped on its head with Ukraine and Russia.
Right. Ukraine has definitely been taking notes on crippling an economy. They've been launching deep strikes far into Russian territory.
Yeah, they hit the Kalino airfield in Kursk, damaged a MiG-29 and a Pantsir system. They hit a massive Wildberries warehouse near Moscow, and most notably, the Novolipetsk steel plant.
That steel plant in Lipetsk is huge. It produces roughly 20% of all Russian steel.
20% from one plant. That is a massive blow. But, you know, I always wonder how effective are these strikes really if a country can just legislate its way out of the economic pain.
Well, Russia is trying to do exactly that. Over the past year, Ukrainian strikes have decimated Russian oil refining capacity.
Right.
So to avoid a domestic fuel crisis, the Russian State Duma just passed a bill to subsidize Belarusian diesel imports using a 0.9 compensation coefficient.
A compensation coefficient? How does that practically work?
Think of it like a grocery store. Your bakery burns down, so you buy expensive bread from across town. But you can't raise prices or customers will riot, so you pay your cashiers out of pocket to discount the imported bread.
Okay, so the Russian federal budget is paying oil companies to sell imported diesel at an artificial loss.
Exactly. It keeps the customers happy today, but it's a massive financial drain. Pure economic attrition.
That makes sense. And we're seeing signs of manpower strain, too. In Ukraine, President Zelensky just dismissed Commander-in-Chief General Sirsky and replaced him with Major General Mikhail Drupidy.
Right. Changing your top commander during such a grueling phase indicates a need for a strategic reset. Drupidy brings a different operational perspective for managing these deep strikes.
Meanwhile, Russia is getting incredibly coercive with manpower. They are passing laws to deport migrants for minor offenses, like unauthorized protests.
Because the deportation threat is leverage. They detain the migrants, threaten deportation, and coerce them into signing military service contracts.
Wow. Just a desperate measure to avoid announcing another general mobilization.
Exactly.
And the conflict is threatening to spread. Polish Defense Minister Ladislaw Kosiniak-Kamysz warned that Russia might use seized Ukrainian drones for a false flag operation against NATO's eastern flank.
And right around the same time, a Liberian-flagged LPG vessel was struck near the Romanian coast.
Using hijacked drones on a neutral commercial vessel creates so much geopolitical ambiguity.
Right. It's the invisible battlefield. You don't need a tank brigade to cross a border to cause a crisis anymore.
You just need a drone and a cargo ship. Which brings us perfectly to our third AOR, the Korean Peninsula.
A rapidly simmering Cold War dynamic.
Yeah. Looking at the border buildup, North Korea built 21 new structures just 52 kilometers from Seoul, near Kisong.
Right. Designed to house multiple launch rocket systems and tactical Erector launchers, forward deploying precision strike capabilities.
Okay, but here's the irony. If we look at the lessons from Ukraine, parking static rocket launchers that close to the border seems crazy.
Because of the drone kill zone?
Exactly.
Right.
Anything within 10 kilometers of the front in Ukraine is dead. So why are they bringing static cannons to a drone fight?
It suggests two possibilities. Either North Korean brass is stubbornly relying on old school artillery and ignoring Ukraine's lessons, or they believe a Korean contingency would look totally different.
Like they could overwhelm South Korean airspace with volume before drones could even deploy.
Right. It's a massive gamble.
Speaking of gambles, Kim Jong-un is making some huge internal moves, a massive joint meeting, the first since he took power in 2011, and he publicly charged General Pak Hee-chol with corruption.
Pak Hee-chol was very powerful in the General Political Bureau, which manages military ideology. Purging him dismantles rival factions and elevates Kim's new people-first ideology.
Consolidating power while trying to look like a hero to the public.
Precisely.
Down south, South Korea has a really complex dual-track approach. Diplomatically, the Ministry of Unification under Chung Dong-young and President Lee Jae-myung, they changed their terminology.
Right. They are no longer using the term North Korean defectors. They are calling them North Korean-born citizens.
A deeply symbolic, conciliatory gesture to appease Pyongyang.
Trying to promote a framework of peaceful coexistence.
But militarily, they are doing the exact opposite. Massive joint exercises with the U.S., like Buddy Squadron and Pitch Black.
South Korea is desperate to prove they are ready for the transfer of wartime operational control, or OPSIN, by 2029.
OPSIN. That's essentially about who actually calls the shots if a war breaks out tomorrow. Right?
Yes. Right now, an American general technically has that control. South Korea wants it back, but they have to prove they have the independent capacity to handle a nuclear-armed North Korea.
So they are telling the North, we respect you as citizens, but we are also practicing air combat maneuvers.
Exactly. And North Korea is building its own network. CCP Politburo member Wang Huning visited, and the pro-Lukashenko Communist Party of Belarus signed a memo of cooperation with North Korea's ruling party.
A thickening autocratic web. It's all connected.
Right.
So stepping back and looking at all these AORs, whether it's militias cutting power in Kuwait, Russia subsidizing diesel, or Kim Jong-un purging generals.
The nature of warfare has expanded way beyond the trenches. It's about strangling the economy, controlling shipping lanes, and managing domestic opposition.
The battlefield is everywhere. Now, before we wrap up, we do want to remind you that all political statements and military actions discussed today were reported purely to convey the information from our open source material.
Right. We are here to provide clarity on the mechanisms of these conflicts, not to endorse any viewpoint or take any sides.
Just reporting the assessment. So
yeah.
I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. We started by talking about how front lines have moved to civilian infrastructure. If global conflicts are now characterized by long-range drone strikes on merchant vessels and targeting global trade choke points like the Strait of Hormuz, the Red Sea, and the Black Sea,
are we witnessing the permanent end of the post-WWII era of secure, neutral international waters?
Exactly. If the oceans aren't safe for business and a militia can choke off global trade with cheap drones, how long can the global economy actually survive? Next time you see a headline about a cargo ship getting delayed, remember they aren't just attacking a boat. They're cutting the wires to the whole house. Thanks for diving deep with us. We'll catch you next time.